This week's episode of Undisclosed is brought to you by Stamps.com. Most of us are trying to find more time every day to get things done. So you can't let trips to the post office slow you down. Now you don't have to, thanks to Stamps.com. With Stamps.com, you can buy and print official U.S. postage right from your own computer and printer. You'll never waste valuable time going to the post office again. Sign up for Stamps.com and use my promo code UNDISCLOSED for this special offer. You get a 4-week trial, plus $110 in bonus offer, including postage and a digital scale. Go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in UNDISCLOSED. Stamps.com and enter UNDISCLOSED. This week's episode is also brought to you by The Message from the GE Podcast Theater and Panoply. Have you heard The Message? Nikki Tomlin, a PhD in linguistics from the University of Chicago, is working on deciphering an alien message from over 70 years ago. Sound crazy? Well, you can follow Nikki's work on the GE Podcast Theater and Panoply's new podcast called The Message. This 8-episode podcast series will blow your scientific mind as you follow the story of Nikki as she works with a team of cryptologists at a research think tank called Cypher to try and decode a message received from outer space 70 years ago. So don't miss a second of this new modern-day War of the Worlds podcast from the GE Podcast Theater and Panoply called The Message. Subscribe today to The Message on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Hi and welcome to Undisclosed, The State vs. Adnan Syed. This episode is Discovery. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and national security fellow, and I blog at splitthemoon.com. I'm joined with my colleagues Susan Simpson and Colin Miller. Susan is an associate at the Volcal Blog Group in Washington, D.C., and she blogs The View from LL2. And Colin is an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and he's also the blog editor of the Evidence Prof blog. It's now been over a year since Serial came out. 12 months and half a dozen podcasts later, Adnan's case is one of the most well-known and well-covered cases out there. If you're listening now to episode 15, then you know a lot about the facts of this case, about the nitty-gritty details. For this episode, though, forget all of that. Forget everything you've learned. Pretend you've never heard of Serial, Adnan Syed, of Haman Lee, of Jay Wilds. And pretend you're an attorney. You've just gotten a new client. He's been arrested for murder, but he doesn't have a clue what happened or why they've charged him. Trial is set for a date 5 months out. The clock is ticking. What do you do? How do you prepare? How do you figure out what happened? In this episode, we'll discuss how Adnan's case came together, or didn't, between Adnan's arrest and trial.
By way of review, before trial, there's a process known as discovery, and this is the process by which the prosecution is forced to disclose information to the defense and vice versa. And undergirding all of this is the concept of due process of law, that in a criminal case, the defendant needs to have advance notice of the basic allegations against him, any exculpatory information that tends to show he didn't commit the crime, and it's all about his attorney being able to prepare and understand what the state has against the client so that this can be attacked at trial through cross-examination and contradictory evidence.
Now, for you civil attorneys out there, you're used to very wide-ranging discovery where you're able to obtain information and documents from just about any relevant source. You can depose witnesses, you can request admissions, you can provide written questions to the other party that the other party has to answer. Almost none of that, however, is available in criminal trials. For various reasons, discovery in criminal trials is severely limited in comparison to civil trials, which seems counterintuitive to me. I mean, someone's constitutional rights are on the line in a very real way in a criminal case, and yet they have very limited means of access to information about the case prior to showing up in court. Chris Floor, Adnan's attorney at the bail hearing, discussed discovery with me in an earlier interview, and here's what he had to say.
One of the discussions that I'd love to hear, you know, more of with the public sort of looking at what actually do we want our criminal justice system to look at? If my son or daughter, you know, got arrested, God forbid, tomorrow, what would I want that to look like? And to me, you know, with how many exonerations we see, how many, police corruption, you know, issues and so forth that crop up, a simple way to be able to deal with that, and again, nobody wants to do it because it takes a lot of time, is depositions. If I fall in front of the hardware store, I'm going to be able to depose people because I fell and hurt my ankle. If I'm charged with capital homicide, I don't have a right to be able to sit down with the lead detective in a room to be able to ask questions of a discovery nature to make sure that I'm not missing anything.
The discovery you get in civil cases is 100 times better than what you get in criminal.
Right.
It shouldn't be that way. And just
absolutely. And some states are doing. I mean, Florida's done depositions for a long time now. I don't think they do it in their misdemeanor cases, but I know that they do it in their felony cases. And, you know, we just have to continually ask, like, what level of justice do we want?
So how did the discovery process play out in Anand's case? If you were Anand's attorney, what would you have known, and when would you have known it? Day one for you is 2.5 months after Anand's arrest. You enter your appearance as Anand's counsel and request discovery from the state that same day, on May 17th, 1999. Under Maryland's rules, the state was required to produce discovery by no later than May 30th. But May 30th comes and goes, and the state does nothing. June passes. Still nothing. It's now been 4 months since your client's arrest. You have no discovery from the state. Things are getting tense. Trial is a little over 3 months away, and you have almost no idea what the state is going to say happened. Despite the state's failure to provide anything to you in accordance with Maryland rules, you do, however, have a few clues about the state's case. They come from four sources.
The first of these sources consists of the news reports on Hayes' disappearance and later the discovery of her body. This comes from an article on February 4th, 1999, and it says, Heyman Lee was last seen about 3 o'clock p.m. January 13th at Woodlawn High School, where she was a student. After school, she was supposed to pick up her six-year-old niece and go to work, police said, but she did not do either. Then this story excerpt comes from a story on February 12th, 1999, and it says in part, Heyman Lee was last seen January 13th, driving away from the Baltimore County School in a gray 1998 Nissan Sentra.
Here are a couple of news clips from February 12th and February 28th.
18-year-old Heyman Lee disappeared on January 13th after leaving Woodlawn High School.
Lee was last seen at school January 13th at 3 o'clock driving her family's Nissan Sentra. She was supposed to pick up a cousin, but never did.
So you have half a dozen articles and news segments that are clear on two basic facts. Hay was alive at 3 p.m. and was in her car driving away from school. But something happened between 3 p.m. and 3:30. She never made it there. Now, after the body was found, a few more details were available.
Police say a passerby found her remains 2 days ago in Leakin Park. Investigators say her body was partially buried approximately 100 yards off the roadway.
The manner and cause of death has not yet been determined by the medical examiner's office. Detectives will work closely with them to determine exactly how long the woman's body may have been in the wooded area, along with the exact manner and cause of death, which will be determined by that office as well.
They identified Lee from her clothing and personal belongings. Police are investigating this case as a homicide.
Police now reveal that 18-year-old Heyman Lee died of strangulation, and that they discovered her 1998 Nissan Sentra a short distance from where her killer attempted to bury her body in a shallow grave in Leakin Park. Key details they had withheld as they sought out a suspect. They now have one in custody.
And then there's an article from March 1st about Anand's arrest, which gives us a few more details. And it says Lee was last seen about 3 p.m. January 13th, driving from school in her 1998 Nissan Sentra, police said. She was going to pick up her six-year-old niece and go to her after-school job at a lens crafter's optical shop. A few weeks later, a man walking in a secluded section of Lincoln Park in West Baltimore found Lee's body partially buried near the 4400 block of Franklintown Road, police said. Her car was nearby.
Based on the media available at the time, shortly after Anand's arrest and shortly after Hay's body was found, there are some facts to go on. However, as we learn later, they're not all correct, such as the fact about Hay last being seen at 3 p.m., which could be true as a factual matter, but wouldn't match the state's claims at trial. We also have things about, for instance, how Hay's body was found, and where the car was found, and how it was found, which are hinted at in these statements, but don't give an accurate picture of what actually happened.
looking at these statements and hearing the clips, I certainly get the impression that there's a witness who sees her actually driving away from the school. I know it's somewhat ambiguous, but that's certainly the impression I think most people would get from the statements in these articles.
Any conjecture on who that might have been?
Well, it's weird because we know that Debbie had said in late January that she saw Hay at 3, but it's just a brief summary of her statement. It makes me wonder whether at first Debbie in fact did say she saw Hay leaving school in her car, but we know that she is the one person who has said she saw Hay as late as 3 o'clock p.m., at least in some versions of her statement.
You also have the statement of probable cause for your client's arrest, and that's the affidavit written out at the time your client was arrested to explain what the evidence was and why the police did have good reason to believe he was guilty of something, in this case, murder. And in this case, this statement of probable cause says, during the last week of February 1999, several witnesses were interviewed at the offices of homicide. These witnesses provided information concerning the death of Haley. Additionally, these witnesses indicated that the above-named defendant strangled the victim to death and buried the remains within Lincoln Park. These witnesses will remain anonymous until trial. Yeah, it doesn't describe anyone seeing these events or anyone having personal knowledge. And as an attorney, I would probably read this and think, okay, maybe they have some witnesses who they say my client bragged to about committing the murder. But there's not much to go on there.
And I would say maybe it's a trivial point, but it's incorrect in the sense that several witnesses, the dictionary definition is more than two. As far as we know, right, it's just Jay and Jen who are the witnesses. There's not a third or a fourth witness who was involved.
A third source of information is from what the cops themselves told Adnan. Luckily for you, Counselor, Ritz is a talker. While interrogating Adnan, he informs him of the following things. Number one, that Jay Wild is a witness. Two, he saw Adnan choke Hay, put her body in the trunk, and bury her. Three, that the police found Adnan's fingerprints all over her car, along with clothing samples and hair samples. Hopefully the cops were just bluffing. They'd only found the car a few hours ago. There's not even been enough time to determine if there's any prints, hairs, or fibers present. The police didn't mention blood or DNA samples. Tools were used to bury the body, and they're going to match them to soil samples in Adnan's car. The cops also added Adnan if it ate him up inside, seeing Hay's face in the trunk and in the hole.
This is actually useful information, or it will be in the future. Because Jay told the cops in his first interview that Hay's face was visible in the trunk. The cops also seem to be acknowledging here that Hay's face could be partially seen based on burial position. The first shows that, well, Jay was lying because in later statements and at trial, he suddenly says that he couldn't see her face because she was face down in the trunk. The latter, well, that's more evidence showing how the body was positioned in the grave and why Jay's story is not consistent with medical evidence. Because based on the burial position that the cops seem to be describing, it's not possible for Hay to have been buried at 7 p.m.
The cops also tell Adnan that witnesses saw Jay and Adnan together after school. But again, hopefully they're bluffing because at this point, there's only one witness who says that, and that's Jen, even though Jay doesn't say that at all. Remember, Jay says in his statements that Adnan dropped him off at his house, Jen came and picked him up later, and actually that no one saw them together.
Yeah, so as of Adnan's arrest, they have one witness singular who's saying this, and their star witness denies that it ever happened.
And at this point, they haven't spoken to not her real name, Kathy.
One thing the cops wouldn't tell Adnan, however, where the murder occurred. Probably because they themselves hadn't figured out which Jay story they wanted to settle on. And the last thing you have is the affidavit in support of the warrant for the search of your client's house, which took place on March 20th, 1999. That affidavit was provided by one of the officers who wrote, on March 15th, 1999, your affiant, along with Detective William F. Ritz, has the occasion to interview a witness to this offense at the offices of homicide. The witness indicates that on 13 January 1999, he/she meets Adnan Syed at a location specified by Syed. Syed, who was driving the victim's auto, opens the trunk and shows the witness the victim's body. This witness observes Syed, who buries the victim in a shallow grave in Lincoln Park. Subsequently, Syed parks the victim's automobile at a location in Baltimore City. Syed then gets into his car and drives the witness to a location in Baltimore County where the digging tools are discarded in a dumpster, along with several items from the victim's purse. The witness also indicates that Syed uses his cell phone to converse with persons during the commission of this murder. The witness also states that he/she engages Syed in conversation several days after the murder of Haman Lee. During this conversation, Syed indicates that he is going to discard his clothing worn during the incident. However, he does not. Additionally, Syed states to the witness that he is concerned about forensic evidence that may be exchanged between himself and Haman Lee during the commission of the murder.
You know, just hearing that, Susan, it's interesting. There's that one line in there. The witness also indicates that Syed uses his cell phone to converse with persons during the commission of this murder. We mentioned before how it seems the initial theory of the police officers was that Adnan actually had the cell phone for most of the day as opposed to Jay. And from that statement, it certainly seems that is what was the belief there, because during the commission of the murder, certainly Jay, at least according to the state's straight trial, had the phone. And even if we're talking about the period when they're dumping the car at the park and ride, that's just one call post that Jay is claiming that Adnan made. So I can certainly see from this affidavit some confusion about who had the phone at the relevant point in time. The other interesting thing is that, according to this version, Adnan tells Jay that he's going to discard his clothing. However, he does not. Well, then why, when they execute the search warrant, does nothing come back from the clothing that tends to tie it to Lincoln Park or the murder at all?
They do have his jacket. The jacket that Adnan was wearing on the day he was arrested is the same jacket that Jay identifies as the one being worn during the murder. So I guess they're thinking if he was too stupid to throw away the jacket, he might have been too stupid to throw away everything else. But look how vague they're being. They're just trying to say he went to a location in the county, he went to a location in the city. It's like they really haven't made up their minds about where things are going to happen. And this way, they keep all options open. And, you know, if they want to make Edmondson Avenue Best Buy instead, they can do that. And if they want to change the park and ride to something else, they could have done that too. That's the other thing. There is no gap between the murder and the burial. By the way the state's telling it, you go straight from killing Hay to Lincoln Park where you're burying her without this four-hour period in between.
And that's huge. We've mentioned before how it wasn't until much closer to the actual trial that Adnan even knew he had to account for his time later in the day. And you're exactly right. Looking at this affidavit, it seems as if we had the trunk pop and you go directly from that to the burial. And there's not this several hour gap that is part of the timeline of trial.
I'm assuming that's because they later discovered that it's possible that Adnan would have an alibi for like track practice and stuff and would not have been able to do that. But what are your theories on that?
I mean, anytime you don't give information to the other side can't defend against it.
Yeah, and this is before they've talked to Coach Tsai, who we know has given a statement to the police in this case indicating he saw Adnan at track practice on a day that only could have been January 13th. So exactly at this point, they might be thinking this all happened in the hours after school ended. And luckily for them, they kept it ambiguous, wherein they could sort of change that narrative later on.
Well, at this point, they're still, I think, or they should be, they're still believing Debbie and her 3 p.m. story. So, I mean, maybe they don't. Maybe now they're starting to backtrack on that. So as of July 1st, where do you stand as Adnan's attorney? The cause of death and autopsy reports are not available. You tried to get a copy earlier in June, but the medical examiner's office told you that they couldn't give you a copy until the prosecutors gave them the okay. Still, from what they told your client during the interrogation, it seems that death was by strangulation. As for location of the murder, you don't know. How the body was found, don't know. How and where the car was found, don't know. Witnesses? Well, there's at least one, and the state keeps using the plural when talking about witnesses. He/she, so you don't know, you know, is it a woman, is it a man? But we know one's Jay. Maybe it's just Jay. Maybe they're bluffing. Still, when did they talk to Jay? Obviously, they talked to Jay before Adnan's arrest, since they keep talking about what Jay said. But according to what the affidavits are saying, he wasn't interviewed until March 15th. But again, on the 28th, when they arrested your client, they told him that someone saw him commit the murder. Only now, in the affidavits are saying the witness didn't see anything about the murder. He/she was called to show up later. So what's going on? All you know is that some witness met Adnan at an unspecified location, then buried the body, then parked the car at an unspecified place before disposing of unspecified tools at an unspecified location. How do you even go about disproving a story that's barely there in the first place?
You know, this makes me think of that point in Serial where Deirdre says that an innocent client can pretty much not help you at all. And I can just imagine at this point,
as Gutierrez is trying to figure out what happened, Adnan has virtually nothing to be able to offer in terms of what could have possibly happened to Hay, and even what the story could be that the state, like what the state's case could even be, other than knowing that Jay is somehow involved.
It's like a Mad Lib of a generic crime. There's blanks where all the important details should be.
Yeah, and it's consistent with the state's policy in this case, which is not to record things, whether it be expert witnesses or their own disclosures. They're keeping it as open-ended as possible so that they're not contradicting themselves later when they, in fact, fill in those blanks. Thereafter, May 30th, the due date for discovery comes and goes without a single word from the state. Then on June 16th, already 2 weeks late on discovery obligations, the state finally files a motion to withhold all discovery in the case until July 26, 1999, saying they have vacation plans that interfere with the ability to comply with their mandatory discovery obligations. Then on July 1st, the defense files its motion to compel production by the prosecution. Thereafter, 1 week later, prior to a hearing, the state makes its first disclosure.
So it's now July, 3 months before trial, and you have your first disclosures from the prosecution. What do they give you? Not that much. They give you this motion that apparently they're going to abandon very shortly after. They give you the names of a few witnesses, ones you already know of, nothing new there. They give you some statements from Officers Adcock and O'Shea. They give you, finally, the autopsy report. They give you the offense charge, the arrest log for Anon. Anon's property log, as in what property he had on him when he was arrested. They give you the results of a ballistics test done on the ammo and casings found near the burial site in Lincoln Park. They give you a fingerprint report that's kind of illegible and has half of it cut off. They give you a lab report, nothing exciting there. And they give you the narrative of the crime scene technicians. So the most basic documents you could possibly have, and nothing about Jay whatsoever.
And that disclosure contains a motion for a joint trial of defendants and offenses. Yeah, so it's interesting that the state in this case files a motion for a joint trial of defendants and offenses. I'm going to quote from a blog post about the prosecution of Michael Johnson in which one of these motions was filed. And it says, the procedure is used when attorneys plan to try cases that include multiple defendants facing the exact same charges in which the parties are usually co-defendants in a crime. The only logical purpose for such maneuvering is to consolidate the state's case when a defendant has turned state's witness against other parties to a criminal act. Now, what I find interesting here is we know that Anon and Jay were not tried together. We know that Jay, at least officially, was never charged with murder. He was charged as accessory after the fact. So it's really confusing that the state, in their disclosure, is filing a motion for a joint trial when, as far as we can tell, there was never any real idea of trying Jay and Adnan together.
What about what Benaroy is saying? Maybe they might have been considering charging Jay with first degree.
Well, this initial disclosure is saying, oh, look, we have at least two defendants who are going to be charged together for a similar crime. But if they were really contemplating that, they changed their minds really fast. Because a week later, on July 8th, the prosecution has a new disclosure in which they give the following response to one of the questions from the defense. There is no unindicted co-conspirator or co-defendant, which means that there will not be a joint trial of defendants like they asked for in their previous disclosure. But it's funny, though, because just 2 months later, Urich will be threatening Jay with a death penalty for his role in conspiring to murder Hay. So the state's opinion on whether or not Jay was involved in the murder was exceedingly flexible.
Where does it fit in? Well, the most likely place to fit in is a statement of a co-defendant, although the state says it's not a co-defendant. The state does have the charging responsibility. They make co-defendants, not the court, not the defense counsel. The state determines who is a co-defendant.
May I respond to that?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Well, Judge, that's the whole point of the motion. If this court is prepared to say, well, they get to call him whatever he is.
No, it's not calling him. It's not calling
him. We haven't raised
Our system vests the executive with a certain amount of discretion. Among the thing, the executive branch, among the bits of discretion they get to exercise, is a determination of whom to charge. That's executive branch. That's not a judicial branch function.
We're not challenging that at all. We didn't raise, Judge, that this is a person who is a co-defendant who's going to be tried jointly with Mr. Syed.
No, the state said that's the only...
We've never raised
The state
that.
Says that's the only possible category into which he fits. You say it's Brady. The state, being mindful of its Brady obligations, says it's not Brady. And I don't see how our determination that he is an accessory after the fact tends to negate or mitigate guilt.
Well, Judge, the whole point is that we are challenging the determination itself. And challenging that, I believe, is in front of this court. If the state were allowed to take a suspect slash co-defendant and within days of charging someone else, determine on their own that no, they didn't believe they were correct by calling him a suspect co-defendant, although they treated him like it. They held him out like it. They submitted evidence from him like it.
There is no holding out. There is no categorization. I'm bound by the rules. I'm also bound by the division of authority under our system. The state determines who or what is a co-defendant. That's not that's not an allegation. That's not a vague category. That's a matter of whether someone does or doesn't have charges lodged. They have an obligation.
That's why we're not arguing.
They have an obligation. Right. They have an obligation to provide Brady material, what tends to negate or mitigate guilt. Now, had they charged him, I presume that would be one thing that would indicate that it tended, perhaps, to mitigate guilt.
Well,
but
Judge,
they haven't charged him.
If you take that hypothetical, then I believe that if you take it to its furthest extent, it shows exactly why the state can never be the one to determine somebody's status. They can
But our system of government gives them the authority. What you're arguing against is the division of powers under
no,
our
Judge,
system.
I am
That's
not.
What you are.
I am arguing
you're arguing with the
only...
fact that they have the authority to determine what is or is not a defendant.
No, Judge, that's not what. For the purpose of what is disclosable.
For the purpose of
only.
What is disclosable, I am bound by a rule that says it's a co-defendant. For the purpose of what a co-defendant is, our constitutional system gives the executive branch the power to determine who is a co-defendant. A co-defendant is someone who
Judge,
is charged.
I'm not disputing any of that.
So from the defense files, we can see that Christina Gutierrez has put together some to-do lists. And they first started in September, with dozens of tasks to be accomplished before the trial in October. Of these dozens of tasks, Gutierrez only assigned two to herself. Number one, letter to Saeed family requesting money. And number two, make a request to view physical evidence, possibly with Adnan. Well, she managed to do the first task, at least. Priorities, of course. But she dropped the ball in the second. As the prosecution wrote in its motion on the day before trial, the defense has made no request to view the evidence or to make any tests of their own. They have been fully apprised in a timely fashion of what the state had and what the state was doing. So yeah, Gutierrez was going to go to trial without ever having taken the time to look at the evidence. In addition to the two tasks she assigned sole responsibility to herself, Tina only even assigned herself to help out with three other tasks. The first thing is a letter to Urich demanding to see the scene with the aid of individuals who were present at the crime scene on February 9th, 1999, and state for appropriate relief. We're not quite sure exactly what that means, but that's exactly what it says.
She did get this task done, like the letter for more money. Apparently this made the cut for what she bothered to do. And she wrote a letter to the prosecution saying, here's what I want to see. It included things like where the car was found, where the body was found, the routes Jay took that day. And Urich wrote back a two-sentence letter saying, I've seen your request. The discovery rules do not require showings. The end. And he's right. They don't provide for it. You don't get to know where everything happened. We're not going to tell you. You can learn it at trial along with everyone else.
The second thing she requested was to review photos of the crime scene. And that was actually done on September 13th of 99.
Partially done, as we've discussed earlier. She didn't see all the photos that day because a couple weeks later, Urich came back and said, oh wait, I just realized I had a bunch more I didn't ever show you that time. Let me know if you want to schedule a new appointment.
I have a question about this. Why wouldn't defense counsel have a copy of these pictures? Why is she expected to just go and view them and then walk away?
I'd say in this case, it's actually strategic. They knew what they were doing. There's no reason why they would give photos in every other case. And suddenly in this one case, they decided not to give over copies of photos because the rules don't technically say they have to. That's not a coincidence. They knew that the photos were damaging and that they wanted to limit that. And they did so by maximizing what they could do under the rules and made Gutierrez come in to look at stuff rather than letting her have her own copies, which would give her time to review them carefully, notice discrepancies, notice problems, notice things that don't make sense. Because in a 1 to 2 hour viewing session in the other party's office, it's hard to get those details.
Now, is this something, Susan, that's Maryland specific? I know I teach adjudication and the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure. There's Rule 16, which involves the government's disclosure. And one of those is that upon the defendant's request, the government has to permit the defendant to inspect and to copy or photograph books, papers, documents, data, photographs, etc. So there are exceptions in cases like child pornography, but generally, upon defense request, defense counsel should be able to make copies and have a permanent record there. Is there something different that we know of under Maryland law?
I mean, the rules in Maryland in 1999 said the same thing. If you're going to use something at trial, you have to produce and permit the defendant to inspect, copy, and photograph any documents, computer-generated evidence, recordings, photographs, or other tangible things. So that's in the rule. Wasn't the rule at the time. But we know from a motion in one of the responses to Gutierrez's demands to get copies of the photos, he says the court ruled that we do not have to give photos. So it sounds like there was a court ruling that held that.
Or Yurik's just making it up.
I hope God not.
It's hard to imagine for me what in this case, as I said, you could get a court ruling and say you can inspect child pornography at the evidence room, but you can't take it out. That makes sense. But something as simple as crime scene photos where we don't have any physical evidence tying the defendant to the crime scene. I mean, that seems essential to try to disprove the state's narrative of the case. And we know that in another case involving Gutierrez in this same prosecutor's office, that lividity was a huge issue. It's impossible for me to imagine almost that the court would have restricted access in this case.
A third task that Tina assigned partially to herself was to make determination regarding alibi. Now, that's what it says. We assume it means, obviously, looking for an alibi for Adnan in the pertinent time period, which apparently was not completely clear to her, but sometime after school. And she assigned that with, I believe it was a law clerk named Mike.
Yeah, Mike was one of the clerks at her office, but he importantly never before this point had met with Adnan in prison. He wasn't the clerk who took the note about Asia McLean, so it's confusing to me. There were two other clerks who had met with Adnan in prison and had discussed what he was doing on January 13th, and yet this clerk who had never met with him in prison is the one put in charge of the alibi defense, which obviously could lead to people falling through the cracks. We have Asia, who is saying she was never contacted. We have his track teammate, Will, who clearly was someone who very easily could have seen him on the 13th. In fact, Jay himself says that Will was there at the end of practice, and yet he's said to Sarah Koenig that he was never contacted. So just sort of disastrous in terms of too many cooks, where it was actually worse to have so many people handling the case as opposed to someone who was talking to Adnan, getting the possible alibi witnesses, and that was the same person put in charge of making these alibi determinations.
As for Asia, we do have handwritten notes taken from one of the clerks from a July 13th visit to Adnan, and those notes do mention Asia. They're the ones that say Asia saw him in the library with her boyfriend. However, in addition to the clerk's handwritten notes they took in the prison, the clerks would also type up a written report after for Tina, in which they summarized their handwritten notes from what Adnan said. And usually these typed up versions were pretty good. They were a good summary of what the handwritten stuff said. But we can see for the typed summary of the July 13th visit, most of the information from the handwritten notes is there in the typed-up summary, but stuff about Asia is not. So it looks like Gutierrez might never have actually gotten a chance to see the Asia stuff.
The handwritten notes were still in the file. You think those would just have been in a separate file and she only would have seen the typewritten ones?
Well, yeah. I mean, usually if an associate has handwritten notes and they type it up, it's because the senior partner is going to review the typed stuff only. And for whatever reason, the notes about Asia didn't make it into the typed-up version.
I've talked about this before, though, and this is what you might recall. The clerk who met with him most often is not the clerk who met with him on July 13th. And in fact, this was the first time any clerk had gone to visit not in prison maybe they didn't know they had to type it up at this point. What we do know is on August 21st, when the primary clerk meets with Adnan, she's covering basically the same ground as the substitute clerk went over on July 13th, which makes me think that Gutierrez, for whatever reason, never saw these notes about Asia and she sort of slipped through the cracks.
On the other hand, if this is what happened, I can kind of see the clerk's logic, because we have Adnan saying, I saw Asia in the library sometime after school ended at 2:15 to 3:15, and then I went to track at 3:30. So that seems kind of irrelevant when you have a murder victim who was last seen at 3 p.m. If the best you can do is a witness who probably saw you before the victim was last seen alive, that's not that useful. And we can see from the list of witnesses that the defense put together, for instance, they have Debbie listed, and in the column for why she's useful, they write, schoolmate and friend of victim. She last saw victim at 3 p.m. So if you're, you know, an associate writing this up, I can see how you would think, well, since we have this witness saying Hay was alive and at school till 3 o'clock, the fact Adnan mentioned that he had an alibi witness from before 3 o'clock, that doesn't matter. Let's just leave it out. It's pointless information.
Yeah, and Susan, just to follow up on that, these were not associates in the sense that they were attorneys. These were law clerks, and specifically they were student law clerks who were tasked with these significant responsibilities. So these were second year, third year law students who, you know, initially during the summer, they probably spent more time there, but as the case geared up, they were juggling their responsibilities at the firm with their classroom obligations. And so it might be a couple hours here, a couple hours there. Obviously not ideal. And this follows up on what we had in the addendum, which is that Mark Martin, the actual associate who was initially assigned to the case and did a lot of this work that eventually the clerks did, left the firm in July, right as we had this Asia visit and everything else with the alibi. So it's easy to see how the inexperience level and people being brought into the case midway through could create these complications.
Oh yeah, no law school student should be in charge of this kind of stuff. I mean, small firms will make use of their summer labor, or their free labor sometimes, or used to be, for law students coming in to, you know, get experience and work. But you don't give them assignments like this and leave them in charge of it, because they just, they don't know enough. It's not their fault at all. You wouldn't expect them to do better.
Yeah, it's one of those things where you wonder, how in the world can you have an alibi witness who directly contradicts the state timeline saying they were never contacted by the defense? And one easy answer is this was a law student who, A, was tasked with the responsibility, and then B, a different law student who was tasked with putting together the alibi defense in the case. So we have two different law clerks who are students handling different aspects of the alibi defense. And yeah, I mean, they're students. They are people who are learning to become lawyers. They're not people who have handled anything close to this level of responsibility before.
What I'm getting hung up on is the fact that, you know, Adnan apparently followed up with Tina about Asia, and she came back and said it didn't check out. But I wonder if, we know he repeatedly asked them to look, that her, Asia's name comes up again and again. And I wonder if it was Tina who told him that, or if it was one of her law clerks. But I believe he's always said it was her directly. So I feel like she, at some point, knew something about Asia.
And I can see as an attorney, you kind of see it as a sign of desperation in your client. Because you have the state saying and the media saying and everything saying, witness was alive at 3 o'clock. Well, and stop talking to me about this alibi witness who saw you at like 2:30. I don't care.
And there's still the theory out there. We have the several notations in the defense files where Hay's best friend Aisha is written out as Asia. I still think the confusion theory where Gutierrez thought that Aisha was the same person as Asia is quite possibly the explanation to everything.
Yeah, and plus it's in cursive handwriting in the hand notes, so like that could be Aisha. So yeah, that wasn't the only very important task that Gutierrez left to the law students to handle. She also let the law student take charge of writing subpoenas.
Yeah, what I found in the task list is that Mike, again, the law student slash law clerk who was in charge of putting together the alibi defense, was also the individual at the firm who was put in charge of checking into Don's alibi and looking into the LensCrafters records for whether he was working at LensCrafters on January 13th. And what we know is, Susan, in this case, we have the two different LensCrafters stores. We have the Owings Mills store, which is where both Don and Hay typically worked. And then we had the Hunt Valley store, which is where Don was supposedly filling in on January 13th. And what we know is the subpoena in this case was actually incorrectly done because it referred to Don as an employee of the Hunt Valley store. And I know people have responded to the filing of a subpoena in this case to try to get the work records as being sort of maybe a bit of a minor task, but it wasn't minor because in this case, the defense was trying to do this under seal, wherein the prosecution wouldn't learn about this subpoena request in the case for the work records. And, you know, we can post the subpoena on the website. There's case law, there's arguments there. And what I'd say is it's not the best constructed argument. It's something typical of what you'd see of a law student, someone who is learning the law and is doing their best job, but it's not something you would see likely from an experienced attorney trying to do this type of motion a couple years into practice.
And there is a whole lot weird with what happened with the subpoenas for Don's time cards. Because, as Colin said, these subpoenas from the defense were ex parte, which means only the court and the defense sees them. They don't go to the prosecution, and the prosecutors don't know what subpoenas are being issued by the defense because constitutionally, the defense has a right to make its case and do its investigation without disclosing its every move to the prosecution. So in September 24th, 23rd, the defense files motions for ex parte subpoenas for PetSmart, where Jay used to work, Coppin State, where Mr. S worked, and also for LensCrafters. What's weird, though, is immediately after this ex parte sealed filing is made by the defense, a few days later, you have a disclosure from the prosecution in which they suddenly say, the state expects to have certified copies of Don's work timesheets at the time of trial. These records may be reviewed upon reasonable request. But here's what we also know. Shortly after the defense did its ex parte request for a subpoena to LensCrafters, the state files its own subpoena to LensCrafters. And the timing looks weird. Why on earth does the prosecution wait until a couple days after a secret filing submitted to the defense to do their own subpoena? It looks like a leak. I really don't see a plausible explanation for this timing, other than that somehow Hurick learned that the defense was trying to get this information. And once he learned of that, he wanted to get involved.
Well, I've heard it's not unusual for certain attorneys, whether it's a state attorney or defense attorney, to have a relationship with, let's say, a clerk at the courthouse. I mean, because the only other person who could have seen this motion under seal when it was filed was either the judge or the clerk of the court, right?
Or possibly one of those law students was a bit incompetent. Not incompetent, that's too harsh. They're law students. You know, and what you normally do for court filings or motions is you send them to the opposing counsel. And maybe one of them just went on autopilot and decided to also serve the ex parte motions on opposing counsel. Either way, the end result is that LensCrafters got two subpoenas in a very short period of time, first from the defense, then from the state, asking for Don's time cards. Now, LensCrafters responds by sending the time cards both to the defense and to the state, but the time cards for January 13th show that Don was not working that day. There's a big old zero under the 13th, and that's it. According to LensCrafters, in their production, after doing a thorough search, in their own words, of their files, they came up with nada when it came to Don working on the 13th. So these time cards come in October 4th. We're about a week before trial, and suddenly LensCrafters is responding to a subpoena and says, here's everything to do with Don working in that time period. He wasn't working on the 13th. 2 days later, on the 6th, LensCrafters makes a second production to the defense, this time providing a single additional time card. And to explain why, after doing an initial production, they've suddenly decided, oh, we found a new document, they just write, in response to your subpoena requesting Don's timekeeping records, please find enclosed an additional timekeeping record, pursuant to a thorough search of LensCrafters records pertaining to Don. This time card shows that Don was working at a different store, the Hunt Valley store, on the 13th from 9:02 p.m. to 1:10 p.m., took a lunch break, and then worked again from 1:42 p.m. to 6 p.m. So there we go. Don has an alibi. They produced it. Good to go. Probably back in, I don't know, January, February, I was talking to Rabia, and she asked me, well, what do you think about Don's alibi? Is that worth looking into? This was when we first kind of started talking. I didn't really know her then. And she asked me that question, and I was like, no, of course not. That's silly. Why are you even asking this? He has documented proof of his alibi. And the prosecutors, the defense, the appeals attorney, serial, they've all looked at it. And if it wasn't legit, they would have brought it up by now. And you, like, said, okay, that makes sense, I guess. But it kind of bugged me because that's a terrible answer. And obviously, in this case, that's nothing that's ever safe to assume. And the question kept nagging at me, so I finally pulled up the records to look at them, just to see, okay, we have time cards here. Do they look like how time cards should look? And when I pulled up the files, I used to do some wage and overtime law. And so when I saw the time cards, my first thought was, for a legit big company like LensCrafters, Luxottica, this is a really atrocious way of tracking time. Because the time cards had two different time cards for Don's work hours. You had one time card for the Owings Mills store, and an entirely separate time card for the Hunt Valley store. Because Don had worked a total of 45 hours that week. Only 12.4 of those hours had been at the Hunt Valley store, and 33.5 hours had been at the Owings Mills store. Which means that he worked over 40 hours and was entitled to overtime pay, but because of this dual tracking system they had going on, that wasn't registering, and Don was cheated out of overtime pay. And then I looked closer and saw, like, well, no, they had a different employee number for each time card, which is not something you do because you want to keep track of the hours an employee works to make sure you don't violate the FLSA and don't have a willful violation that this kind of timekeeping system would cause. So once I saw that, I started looking deeper. And then once you start looking at time cards, they just don't add up. There is something here that is not matching what you would normally expect to see in time cards from a large company that legitimately record someone's worked hours. Now, that doesn't mean the time cards are false. It doesn't mean they're forged. What it means is that there's no way that you can look at these documents and conclude from their face that they are legit, and there's nothing here more to see. But it gets weirder. So I mentioned how after the initial production from LensCrafters, a couple days later, LensCrafters come back and says, hey, look, we found one more document. Here's this magical time card we suddenly found that has Don working on the 13th. Well, they also sent this new time card to the prosecution. But when they did so, they included a different letter than the letter they sent to the defense. Here's what they wrote to Urich. Dear Mr. Urich, in response to your subpoena requesting Don's timekeeping records, please find enclosed an additional record. As stated in our telephone conversation, Don was loaned out from store 143, aka Owings Mills, to store number 128, aka Hunt Valley, on 1/13/99 and on 1/16/99. Also enclosed is the weekly schedule for store 128, located in Hunt Valley Mall, noting the employees who worked there on 1/13/99. In particular, Charles, lab manager, Deborah, sales supervisor, and Anita, general manager on 1/13/99, and also Don's mother. And that's in bold. Whoever wrote this letter from LensCrafters decided to put Donald's mother in bold letters. This letter is very interesting because you have, on the one hand, this record of a conversation between Urich and LensCrafters sometime after the first production. What it looks like to me is that after that production came back and showed Don was not working on the 13th, Urich called LensCrafters up and said, wait, something's not right here, or we need another time card, He did something. Something Urich did caused LensCrafters to find a new record and produce it. However, when LensCrafters did so, all I can think is they had reservations, because there's no reason for them to go out of their way to write, "The general manager is Don's mother," in bold, unless they thought it was important and they wanted to highlight it. To back up for a moment, this is the first contact the prosecutors have ever had with anything whatsoever to do with Don. The prosecutors never spoke to Don. The Baltimore police never spoke to Don. No one has talked to Don in any fashion whatsoever since before Hayes' body was found. Don was only ever talked to in person once, and on the phone twice, and all those times were by the Baltimore County Police during the missing person investigation. The first time was the night of Hayes' disappearance, when Officer Adcock got on the phone late that night with Don. The second time was, again, on the phone when Detective O'Shea called Don up, and he said he'd been working at Hunt Valley that day. Then, a couple days later, Detective O'Shea calls up the Owings Mills LensCrafters, where he talks to Manager Kathy. And sorry for the repeating names. Manager Kathy tells O'Shea, "Oh yeah, Don was working at Hunt Valley that day, and that's it. That's done." O'Shea later meets with Don once. Don says the same thing he said before on the phone, and no one ever talks to Don again. Which means that poor Don was left without a verified alibi because the police didn't do their job. The police never ever talked to anyone who saw Don on the 13th. All they talked to was a single manager at a store where he wasn't working on the 13th. Oh, and that manager was actually his stepmother. So they haven't talked to anyone, not a relative. And they haven't talked to anyone who saw him in person. They didn't even ask for any documents. All they did was talk on the phone to that manager, who was related to Don, have her say, "Oh, he worked that day. Okay, cool, we're done. Case closed." And Don, as a result, didn't get his alibi verified, and he's now stuck without that because the cops didn't take the basic steps needed to check him out and make sure they could rule him out. And now today, I'm sure there's no way he can show whether he was working. And back then, if they'd asked him, you know, he could have said, "Oh, go talk to my coworker who saw me that day. Here's the closed circuit footage that shows me working that day." They did none of that. And now there is no proof that Don actually did work or was at the store on the 13th.
Can we talk a little bit about Bob's findings? Because, you know, you said earlier that you're not suggesting that the time card is fake or falsified, but you're also saying it's not verifiable. Now, I think that's interesting because, you know, people who follow Bob Ruff's podcast, Truth and Justice podcast, formerly known as Serial Dynasty, Bob has been independently investigating and reporting on this too. And he has contacted numerous managers and, in fact, I think one of the actual general managers from the same LensCrafters location, but who was not, I think, a manager back then.
Actually, it was someone working that day.
But he's contacted numerous different people and showed them the documents, and the feedback he's gotten repeatedly is that it doesn't make sense. Like the document that's produced for the 13th is not a real document. And I think specifically the issue there is the employee ID number.
Yeah, well, they don't look legit because no sane company would do things this way. You're putting yourself at a huge risk of a lawsuit because of what happened here. If Don was working that day, again, he lost his overtime for 5 hours because of this system that decided to have his hours tracked on two separate cards. You can't do that. Legally, that's not okay.
And as far as we know, I mean, from what I've seen, I think that's the very first time in Don's employment records that we see him working at the other store with a different employee ID number. So a few days later, apparently, the same thing happened, but that's the very first time that it seems like it ever happened, which is also a weird coincidence, I mean, to be fair. And then another thing that Bob did discuss is, I thought this was interesting, is the fact that apparently the way time sheets are created, when you enter, the time can only be entered before the end of that payroll week, however it works. So it would have had to been entered by the 16th.
Possibly, but at the same time, what bothers me more than that is the weirdness of when the cards got found. Because Luxottica has a, sorry, that's the company that owns LensCrafters, they have a system. They know how to pull records for an employee that show his time cards, when he worked, and what everything. They're not going to do a partial search that doesn't come back with all the records. I don't understand why the first time, in response to Gutierrez's subpoena, they couldn't find that time card for the 13th. But then suddenly, after Yurik called, they could.
Well, if they were pulling his time based on his employee ID, the one he used 99% of the time, then I can see why they wouldn't find
it. But they didn't. They pulled it based on Social Security number. So, I don't know. It's really troubling to me, actually, because this does bother me that Yurik was able to get LensCrafters to produce the magical time card after talking to them when they failed to produce it the first time. And, you know, Yurik never talked to Don. He never talked to anyone at the Hunt Valley store. He never talked to anyone from LensCrafters at all. He has no idea what's going on there. He has no idea if a time card should have existed because the cops never pulled one either. There was never any documentary proof that Don was working that day.
I mean, I do think it's fair to say that at this point, if there, for some reason, the investigation was actually reopened, that these documents probably wouldn't hold up in court.
Yeah, because on their face, I mean, that's the problem here, is that these documents by themselves, they raise too many questions to be accepted as valid, but it doesn't mean Don wasn't working. For all we know, he failed to record his time that day. So this was an attempt to fix that.
Yeah, and my question is, as with many questions in this case, is did Gutierrez actually look at the time cards? How much involvement did she have? We know it was a clerical law student who was in charge of requesting these records. And you can imagine how a student, again, with limited time and experience might look at these and think, okay, these are fine and we're not going to pursue it anymore. Whereas Gutierrez, who for any number of reasons should have known this information, but should have known lots of other information in the case. It might just be another case where she dropped the ball and just had no idea about these things that they look like irregularities. And it's tough 16 years later to say anything conclusively. And that's in part because this was never investigated by the defense. It's something where we know back in January, Debbie is basically the first person interviewed in this case as an eyewitness. And she says, I saw Hey, at 3 o'clock on January 13th, she was on her way to see Don. That's what's repeated in the news articles we noted, in the video clips. Clearly, this is something that any defense attorney worth her salt would have investigated. And I don't know whether she actually even looked at these records to make the assessment about their reliability.
I don't know why the cops felt so comfortable without ever checking out a witness who doesn't have documents showing he worked that day. They never talked to anyone at the store who saw him that day. And you have two pieces of evidence suggesting the witness was on her way to see him. Debbie, like Colin mentioned, and the note found in Hay's car, which they believe was written on that same day, which says, hey, cutie, sorry I couldn't stay.
I think the answer to that is that, you know, I mean, they also didn't know the relationship. They did not discover the relationship of both the manager at Owings Mills and the manager of Hunt Valley to Don. So, you know, if you have a police officer calling a manager, this manager's like, yep, here are the hours. He was clocked in at this time, clocked out at that time, lunch at this time. You know, I wouldn't second guess that. I mean, I have no idea. That's his stepmom, right? And the other one's his mom. But that's also part of the failure of the investigation, I suppose.
This has always been a huge question for me. I'm sure it's been a huge question for many of the listeners is, what caused the state to shift the timeline? Where initially, for a long time, it appears they're working off the theory that Debbie is the last person to see Hay alive at 3 p.m. And obviously, by trial, that shifts. It becomes Inez Butler Hendricks, and it becomes the 236 Best Buy call. Now, as part of it, that they look at Debbie's statement and they see that Debbie said that Hay was going to see Don, they realize that there are issues with that. I mean, it's the new boyfriend, and did they sort of have a type of confirmation bias where they're disregarding contrary evidence? Do they recognize this was contrary and decide we're just going to shift the timeline and hope that the defense misses it? Certainly appears that that's ultimately what happened in the case.
Or maybe they were scared the track alibi would hold up and Gutierrez would notice that there was only one day Coach Sly could be talking about. In which case, if the murder's done by 2:30, well, track doesn't matter. Again, there's no alibi in the track practice, because the murder's over and done with before he ever shows up at track at 3:30. I mean, it's like Schrodinger's case. It's just, you never know what the case against you is going to be until you show up at trial and the state's forced to choose something. And at that point, they know what you're going to do. They know what you have and what you don't. And you are stuck with the best version of the state's timeline that they can run through because they've never disclosed it in advance and you can't defend against it. Or you can't prepare a defense against it.
And this is what frustrates me so much is that you partially can. We know at the second trial, Debbie is asked, I believe twice, by the prosecutor, about January 13th, and she says that she recalls seeing Hay at 3 o'clock p.m. She's referring to her January statement, and the defense never follows up and asks, okay, and when you saw her at 3, what did she say? She said she was going to see Don. I mean, it just completely boggles my mind that Gutierrez did not at trial ask for the detail regarding that statement by Debbie where she says at 3 o'clock, I'm going to see Don. I mean, it's just elementary that she would bring that up, and she just never mentioned it at trial.
I wonder what she was doing. I mean, her to-do list is so short, and she didn't even do all the tasks on it. How was that it? Was that those few tasks? Is that all she ever did for this case? And then she showed up to trial to wing it?
Aren't conceding anything, and we're not conceding that the state understands the rules. And we're certainly not going to concede, given every single step of the way they have refused to give to discovery, they have withheld it, they have fought it, they have sought to disqualify counsel, they've sought to hold up discovery for that reason, although it has no relationship at all. They've sought to extend the time limits 25 days after the time limits had already passed. They refuse to give even the most basic thing, and everything that they have given, there's not a single thing that has been given, either as to witness statements, as to police reports, that is full, accurate, and complete. So under those circumstances, we are not willing to make an assumption that they know what Brady is.
It's ironic that during a phase called discovery, in this case at least, the state did its best not to let Tina discover much of anything about what Adnan would confront in court. It also didn't help that she was stretched so thin with over half a dozen murder cases and an illness that kept getting worse, that much of the evidence gathering itself was left to be done by law students, and the available evidence that she did have, she really failed to examine before the trial. This is what I call a train wreck happening in slow motion. But let's imagine that Adnan had another attorney. He had you, counselor, and you are totally on your game. Here is what you're up against. Here's what the state has produced to you. You're a month before trial, and you still have no answers to the biggest issues in the case. Who are the witnesses? Who saw or heard about the murder and the burial? Where any of the events took place? What time the murder took place? What the star witness who claims to have seen it is going to say or has said to the police, and whether any evidence exists that matches the witness statements. You have no idea if anything any of the witnesses have said to the police has been corroborated. You essentially are working blind. And worse yet, many of the things you think you know, like when the victim was last seen alive, are actually drastically different from the case you're going to be confronted with once you show up at the trial. What's an attorney supposed to do in this situation? How can they respond? Well, you go to the court for relief. And Tina tried that. She filed multiple Brady motions trying to get the court to force the state to hand over evidence. Like the other hundreds of little pieces in this and in any case, how the court handled these motions would deeply impact the outcome of what came next, the trial. Next time on Undisclosed. Many thanks to Ramiro Marquez for our theme music and photography, to Christy Williams for our website, and to Baluki, who designed our logo. Our production consultant is Rebecca Lavoy. She's a true crime author and hosts the podcast Crime Writers on Serial. Dennis Robinson is our producer, and you can find us online on social media on both Facebook and Twitter. Our Twitter handle is UndisclosedPod. Make sure to tweet us your comments and questions using the hashtag Undisclosed.
The Undisclosed Podcast is brought to you in part by the Adnan Syed Trust, a legal defense fund that helps to pay Adnan's legal fees and associated investigative efforts. All proceeds raised through advertising on today's episode of Undisclosed were given to the trust. To learn more about the trust and to donate to our efforts to free Adnan, please visit www.launchgood.com/freeAdnan.